and welcome to the Bookends Cafe. I'm with my trusted colleague, Judith Leacock.
Good afternoon.
And together we drop this Bookends Cafe into iTunes on a Monday afternoon. I guess you might be wondering, why on earth are we doing a podcast? Well, no reason other than the fact that we're working women. And we know that there are other working women out there who like and who need to relax, but who might be using podcasts to be interested in and dedicated to listening to the opinions of others. And one thing Judith and I have in droves is opinions. So welcome to the podcast. Today we're going to be talking about understanding the mental load. And this mental load is doing the rounds at the moment based upon probably a new podcast called Ladies, We Need to Talk. It's an ABC podcast with Yumi Steins as the compere. And it's probably another one of those very female podcasts where lots of issues about babies and pay gaps and, you know, inequities. So you've got to take a little bit of a grain of salt because it can get a little bit of a bash. But certainly I'm enjoying it and I've learnt two things. Certainly this whole idea of understanding the mental load, and it's predominantly for women. So it's how much physical work they have to do, but what you know to be true, how much mental work that goes in with the physical load. So you know that you've actually organised something, say a birthday party, but the mental load and the fatigue that comes along with organising that birthday party is, I don't know how many more times multiplied than actually the physical workload. But certainly there's this lovely YouTube clip going around about understanding the mental load. So I'm hearing it called out now about mental load. The other thing that Yumi talks about, and I loved it, it's a phenomenon that I know you aspire to, and it's called the angry clean. This spring, I've actually found myself in angry clean mode, being just brutal with baby toys and McDonald's little bits and bobs and books. And so I even sort of went through my own bookcase and threw out five bags of books, but I don't know why I've been keeping these books for 10 years. So it's just an angry clean. And one thing I do know is actually decluttering and doing angry clean afterwards makes you feel so much better.
That is a very particularly feminine thing.
Is it?
Women understand the angry clean. You said that to a man, they go clean. They go for the word clean. That's all they hear. They don't use the angry, they're going clean. But, yeah, only women know that one.
I think it's very productive.
It is. But it's very good.
You know, you do find you sort of hit your elbow into a wall and you sort of bruise your shins.
Lots of very little language.
Very, very productive. Very, very productive. So I might kick off. One of the things that I've been doing this week is coaching an individual who, rightly or wrongly, and it ties into the whole mental load, is a high performer. He's certainly someone who's been with the organisation he works with for a very, very long time, and he's very well aware of the mental load that goes on with his role. As I say, he's a very high performer, but it's ironic. The reason for his coaching is because he's a perfectionist. I think that that's terribly ironic because I don't think there's a fine line, right, between time versus quality. And we've been spending a little bit of time, and I don't know whether or not people have heard of the time versus quality curve. It's the basis of Pareto's principle, the 80-20 rule. So basically you, for a job that's good work, perhaps not great but good, it's achieved within about 80% of the time. So that last 20% between the 80% and the 100% is that band of perfectionism, which is deeply ironic, but literally it takes approximately 4 hours in a 10-hour task. This is based upon the theory of the time versus quality curve to produce the last 20%. So if you've got a task that takes 10 hours, getting to 80% is 6 of those hours, getting to 100% is 4 hours. So the call out for perfectionists out there is a good use of your time. That last 40% is literally not worthy of that. The last 20% is not worthy of 4 hours. What do you think about perfectionism? Is it deeply ironic or is it appropriate?
Look,
can we do 100% all the time?
No, and I mean, classically, perfectionism is a real issue, and particularly for someone who wants to be a leader, because you can't be a strong leader and be a perfectionist. It can't work.
Mm.
All the research shows that one of the impediments to being a good leader is the desire to do everything absolutely perfectly.
Mm.
And that isn't the way we're wired.
Mm.
We're not wired to do that. And unfortunately for these people who have it, who have this desire that everything has to be perfect, it absolutely does three things that are really serious for them. Absolutely squashes creativity.
Yeah.
None of the people who are perfectionists will be creative because they are so busy trying to finish each of the a particular task or thing to the standard that they have specified.
Mm.
So they don't create.
Yeah.
They don't even look at alternatives, which, of course, a good leader will do. You know, a good leader will look at, okay, we're going in this pathway, got a bit of an issue. Let's look. Is there an alternative? Is that, you know, can we look at new ways? No. So creativity's gone. It makes people feel like they're being judged and not inspired. So they're not good with a team. So because if they're judging you against their level and their standard of performance and they expect you to do it the same.
Yeah. Yeah.
So unfortunately, they're not good team leaders. They're not good team players either, but they're certainly not a leader. And the third thing that certainly all the research has shown is that it absolutely increases stress levels.
Okay.
Because in that last piece, as you're saying, in that last segment of a project to get to the, you know, get to completion, they will be so stressed about minutiae, you know, the presentation, the way the product looks, that they will be incredibly stressed. And as we all know, stress levels go up in a leader. What happens to the team? Stress levels go up in the team, productivity falls, and you don't get an outcome. Mm. So you've got a poor person who is expecting everything to be perfect and the world is falling out of their project. So it's a real issue and people have to be guided. And this is people who are of a perfectionist slant
or what
need good coaching.
Keep going, but he said to me, I'm not a perfectionist, I'm a good finisher.
And we'll see, I mean, that's the denial piece.
Yeah.
Because if he's got all those other symptoms going on, if you can see that in his behaviour at work or his direct report, his manager can see that and is quoting that, he's a perfectionist. He's not a good finisher.
Yeah.
And they're actually not good at finishing because they never, you know, they don't get
really
there. Yeah. So, yeah, absolutely strong coaching. They need to be allowed and encouraged to look at alternatives.
Mm.
They're very bad decision makers.
Mm.
And as a leader, as a team leader, you've got to make decisions. They won't make a decision that doesn't reflect their idea of how things should be.
Mm.
So they need to be coached to look at alternatives, to make decisions that are outside their frame of reference for a particular project. It has its place.
Yeah.
But it's not something that is an attribute that will make you successful as a leader or as a, to be honest, a coach. You could never coach someone if you're like that because you would be trying to, make them the same as you. But, unfortunately, there's a lot of people who are fit into that category.
And you wonder why the whole idea of perfectionism equates to being perfect. One of the things that with this same particular fellow, and I said he's a really high performer, he, over the years, we've been that, you know, he's priming himself into thinking there's a very good finisher. I think it's because he's just not being noticed as much as what he was. And he talked a little bit about being invisible. And we know being invisible hurts. We talked about in our second podcast, I think we called it I Don't Care What You Did on Tuesday, because I loved it. That was your, is this mature age workers, particularly older women who are in the workforce, feeling invisible.
Yeah.
I've been watching on SBS, I don't know whether you've sort of seen it, but that show, Look Me in the Eyes, isn't that powerful?
Mm-hmm.
For people that, I mean, some of them it's very confronting.
It is.
But for some that have felt invisible because of their parents or of their partners, it's producing some results.
And if you get an outcome that means a relationship can be at least band-aided and allowed to, for a communication to take place. But I do have an issue that people need to sit in front of a camera and behave like that.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, really, seriously, in life, if you have a broken relationship, you need to deal with it in the environment in which you're both comfortable. But, yes, I think that what they are trying to get and the message that I appreciate is that eye contact, looking at someone, means that you're also listening to them. And that's when you look at all these stories, you know. Yeah. I've only watched a couple because I must admit I'm not a great
fan. I feel a bit awkward. I sort of have to look away. It's not so
exactly. But you get the message and you make your people understand. Mm. But you will believe you are not being heard if I'm not looking at you, right? I could be sitting here moving my papers. I'm listening to everything you say.
Yeah.
You are going to believe I'm not listening.
Yeah, yeah.
And so a relationship that's already fractured is absolutely dynamited because they believe they're not being heard. The eye contact is essential.
So powerful.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
This is how people get jobs. This is when you go for an interview, you get a job because you look at the people who are speaking to you, asking you questions. You move around the panel. There's the lesson, you know, eye contact, even in a simple environment, is powerful because people can see that you are attending.
Yeah.
Yes, you can be nervous. That's right.
Yeah.
But you are looking at each of the panel and you're responding appropriately. And if you then think of something that panel member over here asked you before, you go back to them and say, oh, I just, you know, if you don't mind, I'd just like to add to that.
Yeah.
Again, shows one, that you're capable of thought, so you, you know, you can come back to a thought.
Yeah.
Two, manners.
Yep.
Three, you're listening to them and they're listening to you.
And it's a good segue because I know certainly the instruction that I took from this fellow's manager is that he's a terrible listener.
Yeah.
I did give him the book. It's an older book. It's a 2009 book called The Lost Art of Listening by Nichols. I loved the Lost Art of Listening concept, and I've used the Lost Art of Listening survey in, you know, I guess transformational change. Yeah. And it does, in my own experiences, reflect that Australians don't tend to have a good listening skill, certainly because of the dozens of times I've run this survey in a workshop. I haven't had too many Australian members of my courses or of coachees rating either themselves from a self-assessment point of view or through a triangle, so they've got to do two other people, as being anything other than average in this survey. So there could be something wrong with the survey, and it might not be the best way to assess listening, or that's a bit of a reflection as to how maybe chain of command, you know, we are in Australia and we just don't listen. What's your thought about those two?
Oh, look, I think, you know, I'm pretty critical of the surveys because I think they're, you know, when you look at the questions seriously, you could either mark yourself as, you know, the greatest thing since sliced bread, or you can mark yourself as Mr. or Miss Average, which is what most people would do.
Yeah, true, true.
And the other thing, you know, what they've found is when in any assessment of listening skills, people respond or believe in their responses reflect. It's a bit like asking them, are you a good driver?
Yeah.
Everybody says they're a good driver.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And you and I both know there are so many crap drivers on the road that, you know, it's lethal.
That's probably
so
me,
there
really.
Are so many crap listeners as well. But, you know, people are going to say, yes, I, you know, I listen.
Yeah.
But the trouble with all of these surveys is they don't actually define. What are you asking?
Yeah.
What does listening mean?
Yeah, so what do good listeners do?
It doesn't mean that you can, you know, just because you hear what's being said, you've heard the words, doesn't mean you've listened to the whole meaning or the whole conversation.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, if they defined it first, what we actually are after, what we're looking for in relation to what we mean when we say, are you a good listener?
Mm.
That would give me a little bit more comfort.
Yeah.
But seriously, I would rather they did some psychometric testing first off because that will give you, you know, there are certain personality types that won't listen.
Yeah, yeah.
The bold, the arrogant, you know, they're not going to listen.
No, no.
Or some exercises, some role play where they actually have to. And, okay, it's pretense, but you're not assessing their acting ability. You're assessing how they eye contact when the person spoke. Where did their eyes go?
Yeah.
Then that'll tell you whether they're listening and whether they're good at it because they feel comfortable enough to look at people. So I think they're, you know, they have their value, but I think they do need to be carefully defined. And I think if that was, you know, on the basis of a criteria for a job, a certain score in a questionnaire like that, that would be absolutely wrong.
That would
because it's not giving you a true picture of what someone can and can't do.
But certainly it's quite a cathartic moment for this fellow because when he self-assessed himself as being an average listener, I think it starts to put in context why he is feeling a little bit invisible and certainly why he's backsliding to that whole idea. It all has to be perfect.
Perfect,
Have you ever felt invisible?
Yes, and it's funny because it's just recently I had a very interesting experience. And putting it in a context, first off, I am a very experienced executive. I am a confident woman. I am well-educated. I can communicate, I believe, with multitudes of people from any walk of life. Because I've developed and I've learnt and taught myself and, you know, educated myself.
Mm.
So this is a really simple thing. My husband and I having some renovations done, right? So we had selected this particular landscaper to come and give us a quote, met him. My husband had met him before, very nice bloke.
Yep.
All of about 30, right? So at no time in the conversation when we're standing in our house, outside our house, organising all this, did he do two things? Have eye contact with me,
really?
And I'm speaking, right?
Yeah.
Because
how
could I not?
Yeah, yeah.
Right? How could I not speak,
really? Yeah.
Have no eye contact. And even worse, And I know this sounds pathetic, but this is how I operate. I read people. I read body language. I'm a great believer in, you know, your body language says volumes about you.
Yeah.
At the end of the conversation, he shook hands with my husband and he turned around.
And that was it.
So I said, I just stuck my hand out in front of him. And up he goes. He went up and he shook my hand. Really?
You know, 27
and exactly. And he's only 30.
Yeah.
Now, he's a very nice man.
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
he's very, very good at his job.
Yeah.
But I thought, how dare you consider that that I am of no importance in this relationship?
Mm.
And the ridiculous thing is, I have always earned more than my husband.
Yeah.
I have been the major breadwinner in the family.
But he wouldn't.
I've worked.
That.
No, no. But what I mean is, I'm the most confident member of our in our relationship.
Yeah.
And my husband will tell you that.
Yeah, hates it.
Yeah, exactly. But you know, here it is. Yeah. He's assuming because there's a man.
Yeah.
That the man will do the talking.
Sucks.
And that the man will make the decision.
Mm.
And you know, I thought it's really sad.
Yeah.
You know, and much as I'm not holding it against him because he got the contract.
Yeah.
And he started work.
You have to try and get him to.
But I thought he's got to learn because, you know, he is way too young to be doing that. He's way too young to be not looking at the two people who are going to pay him a significant amount of money.
Yeah.
And he should have eye contact with both of us. At the okay, if he didn't want to during the as we're walking around, fair enough. I'll accept that.
God help
but
him.
But he should have looked.
I'll have to give him a ring to say, look, you know this driveway that you're doing? You're going to get more than you bargained for. You're going to be coached to in an interview live.
But isn't that sad, though?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I've taught my two adult children.
Yeah.
You look at whoever is speaking, first point. Second point, you acknowledge whoever you meet.
Yeah.
Now, this handshaking thing, this is a, you know, for women, this is a comparatively new thing. By that, I mean, you know, 20 years ago, we didn't shake hands.
No.
When I was, you know, first sort of the executive position, we'd shake hands.
Yeah.
And that's the kissing on each cheek. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Nobody came near my face.
Whereas I think it's non-negotiable, and I always coach my women about actually having a good firm handshake.
Absolutely. Yes.
And even making sure that your bag's on the other side so you don't brush your chest.
Yes.
There's a real art to it. But speaking of terribly sad, just related to the invisibility thing, I've been watching that or basically pouring through that Netflix, I'm not sure whether it's a documentary or whether it's a fiction, I don't know, but it's called Time, the Caliph Bowder Story on Netflix. It's about a young boy who was put in Rikers Island for 3 years, literally because of just delays and an overrun. Obviously an African-American boy, very poor background. And Jay-Z is one of the commentators, Beyonce's husband, you know, basically for just allegedly stealing a backpack. And he's 16. You know, it's just the invisibility of young black African-American boys in juvenile detention or on Rikers Island was just, and you know, he's speaking openly about how his life, it was a fork in the road for him. He was planning on making some positive change and we'll never know. But now he's just said, look, the only way I'm going to be able to make it in life is by being a bigger criminal now than what I was before. Deeply, deeply depressing. But what's not depressing is the book that I gave you to read, and I know you said you really liked it, probably not really to do with anything about the mental load, or maybe it is. It's an older text called The Design of Everyday Things, and I've never read this book, but a girlfriend actually said it's one of her favourite books by Don Norman that she's ever read. So we got it, and you read it.
Yep.
What's it like?
Oh, look, first off, it's an easy read, but it is textbooky in inverted commas.
What's it about, though? Is it about design?
It's about design, but it's about what designers have to or should consider when they're designing something.
Okay.
So he's saying that, you know, if a designer doesn't look at human physiology, so doesn't look at how the brain works, doesn't look at psychology, doesn't look at how people behave, if they don't look at how we function in society, how can you design something that's going to be acceptable to the populace? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Simple example, and I love this example because it's absolutely true. A stove.
A stove.
Right?
Okay.
We all have them.
We all
have to buy them at some point, right? A stove is always designed with the hot plates on the top, right?
Yeah.
And they're either in sort of a square, so lines.
Yeah, yeah.
Or they're, what do you call that, zigzag.
Zigzag,
right?
Yeah.
Okay. The dials to turn each of those jets on, what are they in? Absolutely always horizontal line.
Yeah, yeah.
You have to then work out by looking at the picture, scratching down there, looking.
Hang on, that's not right. Yeah. I just try them.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
And he has asked over probably 10 years, why don't they make them zigzagged on the front?
Oh, yeah.
Not one single stove. I've just bought a brand new stove. It's magnificent, state of the art.
Yeah, yeah.
Horizontal line of all the little knobs. And he's saying it's a simple thing that our brain, when we visualise the top of the stove, right, we've logged that.
Yeah.
We've got six burners.
Yeah.
Right, three and three. We go to look at the buttons.
Hmm.
And it doesn't compute because it's not matching what we have visually taken as a cue to operate.
Yeah, yeah.
So we then, like you turn them all on. Yeah. I at least scratch down, put my glasses up and try to work out what I'm looking at.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm usually good at rolling. But no, but he's saying that's just a simple, there's lots of examples in here, but that is a simple example. And he said they won't change.
Yeah.
They won't change. He said, you know, we should stop buying stoves, but of course we can't. But there are lots of simple examples about where either a designer has taken account of biology and psychology or they haven't. Yeah. Where they haven't, how it's spectacularly failed. We simply won't use it or we can't use it or it's not comfortable. Yeah. If we're not comfortable, we won't use it.
Is that right?
Yeah. And
we don't persevere, do we?
No.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
Although we said, you know, sometimes they have made more money because we bought it thinking it's great and then dumped it.
Yeah.
And so we've spent the money so that they made a profit.
Yeah.
But in actual fact, they don't have the next, they don't have the continuing sale because we don't want it again.
Yeah.
We'll never go back.
It's a boom bust.
Exactly.
So is it a good book?
Absolutely.
Okay.
I recommend it, particularly also if you don't understand how the brain works. If you actually don't understand the connect between our visual acuity and our, if you like, our, and I've talked about this in a previous podcast, our filing cabinet, how we store information in the upper brain and then we could take it to the deep brain because he talks about that, you know, he talks about how we actually store stuff so that we can call it back when we're using something that's similar but not necessarily the same, but we can call it back and go, oh yeah, now I've got a similar thing, if I try that I'm sure that might work, and we'll be brave enough to try it,
okay,
you know? But if we haven't seen it before or if it's so different in that you've changed the dials completely, then we're lost. We either won't bother or we ask for help.
And certainly, you know, the whole iPhone and just how smartphones have, and whilst I hated that book, the Steve Jobs book, I found it an awful read, you know, just the beauty that he had for design.
Good. And it's because
a wonderful design.
But he did make it for people. Like his whole, yes, I mean, the book is depressing, but his whole being was that it has to be using people's own ability to enjoy it.
Yeah.
And to be honest, I've learned more having to adapt to technology.
Yeah, okay.
I've learned more from the technology itself than I've learned from the experts trying to teach me or from the bloody handbook, which is
so intuitive.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So once I, and when I, and I'm now even brave enough to play, I will actually press things and see what happens.
Mm.
Whereas six years ago, I wouldn't know. You either tell me to press that, I answer the phone with a swipe, that's it. Now, when they changed the direction of the swipe, that nearly killed me. I couldn't answer the phone. I didn't answer the phone because it wouldn't work. Because I didn't realise it actually changed directions. It went up, sideways, and it went up. Oh, God.
I found myself on the way home from WA a couple of weeks ago, and I actually fell into this movie called Dior and I. Now, I know you love Dior, and I know you love – I've really never been creative and understand – just the beauty and colour and fabric. And, God, it's a lovely film.
Mm.
It's a documentary about the new Dior chief designer and actually his first collection.
He
unpacks the beauty of his fabric and he unpacks and you actually get behind the scenes of the ladies who are actually all making the gowns.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah, and you know, some of them have been there 35, 40 years and they think that, you know, the ghost of Dior walks around you know, and the fellow who's in charge now, he's a minimalist. So they're obviously changing the design of Dior, long minimalist lines. He's not a minimalist, but they were really sort of taken by his new design strategy for the new collection. But God, it's a lovely film. I don't know if any people are listening have got just that feeling of wanting to be taken away and completely in romance with design
and the
clothing
beauty of something.
And the beauty of something. And it's wistful and it's, but yes, very, you learn something.
Hmm.
Yeah.
And you know what, just an aside, because I haven't seen it, but I'll watch it. What's going to happen when these very experienced women go?
Yeah. The good thing that I know about actually the Dior, you know, the seamstresses, the movie has it so that they're about 50-50 older ladies who just love working with design and young gay guys. And those young gay guys are doing these huge, big, buffy frocks, really complicated design. And so that's how I think
it's going to continue. Oh, that's okay.
Yeah, so there
is a sort of a next generation.
Yeah, but very camp.
Yeah.
On that note, thanks everyone.
Bye.
See you next week.